Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up, and we are broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Peoples. If you're tuning in and wondering whose voice this is, I haven't heard this person before. My name is Kira. I am simultaneously a new and old programmer here on Speak Up. I got involved with CJSF in 2019, and my voice has been kind of jumping around from show to show for the last 4 years or so. But Speak Up has always held a very special place in my heart, so I'm very excited to be back in studio and talking to you about interesting stuff happening out in the world. On that note, I've got what I think is a very interesting show planned for us today, which is entirely centered around care as a concept. There's kind of a few segments to this show today, so we're going to start off with a discussion that I had yesterday morning with Chantel Spicer, who is an employee of Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. And we had a really interesting conversation about the misunderstandings of abolitionist movements and the kind of essential, not kind of, the absolutely essential overlaps between care and abolition. And we're going to follow that conversation up with a special segment that is a collaborative piece between CJSF and Leave Out Violence BC, which is a not-for-profit that I'll be talking about later. And that special segment is going to be featuring the voices of youth on their own experiences of and feelings about care and what that means to them. Needless to say, I'm very excited. I really enjoyed putting together today's show, and I hope that it's insightful and meaningful to everyone out there listening. But first, let's ease into our day with some music before we hear from Chantel. We're going to start off our morning with a track by Andy Schaaf. This is The Moon, and it is off of his album, not his most recent one, the one before that, which is called Neon Skyline. Andy's one of my favorite musicians, so I hope it's enjoyable to you as well.
Are you gonna mope all night? I focus my eyes, I guess he's probably right. Did you drag me off of my couch so we could sit here in silence until we say goodnight? He says we need a change of scene. Let's go to the bar around the corner where it's always dark. And as we're putting our money down, Claire's asking Charlie if we're hitting the town. He says we're making our way to the moon and we're taking off soon. She says I'd be down for the moon, but I didn't bring my helmet. She catches me rolling my eyes, so I say I packed a spare. I don't think it saves me, but she doesn't seem to care. She's asking Rose for her bill, and just as she's paying, Judy walks in the door. She's giving Charlie a hug. She asks where we're going. He says we're making our way to the moon and we're taking off soon. to hold. I didn't think it was that funny the first time around. Claire asked if she'd like to join. She says that'd be nice, and I don't know what the hell's going on, but soon we're walking the street. Charlie's walking with Claire, and Judy's walking with me. I say I didn't expect to see you. She says, to be honest, I knew exactly where you'd be. And I say, making my way to the moon. And she laughs too soon. Feeling pours over me, reaches to the pit of my stomach, so I reach for her hand. She pulls it away from me. She says, you know, it can't be like that. We'll just make our way to the moon, and I'll see you soon.
All right. I am here with Chantel Spicer, who is one of the many wonderful people who is keeping SFPIRG going and bringing more and more people into the wonderful work that SFPIRG is doing. Hi, Chantel.
Hello.
For those who are listening and who might not know about SFPIRG, could you give a quick little blurb on what y'all do over there?
Yeah, I can give it a go. So we go by the name SFPIRG because our full name is the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, and that's really quite a mouthful. But we are a student-run not-for-profit at SFU Burnaby campus. We're based out of the Students' Union building. We have been a not-for-profit since 1981. Here in Burnaby, and our purpose as an organization is to, our mandate is so broad. It's to serve as a hub of resources and support for students who are doing social or environmental justice. I personally consider environmental justice like social justice, like they're very intertwined for me. But the way that I try and explain it to people is thinking about all of the terrible things, like students are often learning about like literally the worst things that are happening in the world, and they're learning about them in a way that it's like analyzing them and like writing a paper and theorizing them. But obviously when you're learning about things like that, you're like creating quite a lot of anxiety about the world that we exist in and the world that we're like moving towards. So our job here at the PIRG is to connect students to ways to make change towards those issues. So we do our work through two kinds of branches. Like we support students who are already doing social justice work, but then we also do a lot of like education skills and training for folks who might be newer to social justice work.
Awesome. Yeah, I actually got involved with SFPIRG when I was a student at SFU because I was studying sociology, and I was like, oh my goodness, I am learning about all of the problems that are like just like embedded in my surroundings, and I need to not just learn the theory and learn the thoughts, but learn how to like take action and move through the world while having this knowledge. And yeah, SFPIRG was probably one of the best parts of my university experience.
Oh, I'm so good to hear that.
Yeah, everyone I met there was just an absolute gem of a human being.
They are. Yeah.
Yeah,
I learn from them every day.
Yeah. So one of the things that I did when I was involved with SFPIRG, I worked with Chantel and another, like a larger group of people on an abolitionist project at SFU. And we're kind of here to talk about abolitionism today, just more broadly. One of the things I've noticed, and I'm sure this is something that is kind of resonates for you as well, Chantel, is that abolitionism is often very misunderstood. I think people, it's such a, the word in itself feels so absolute, and brings up a lot of ideas of just like, it's just a destruction. And I think that there needs to be, like, hopefully more, like, accessible discussions about what it is actually, that it's not just this, like, destruction of something that people don't like. It's actually a much more integrated system of care, and that's hopefully what we'll talk about today. If you have a definition of abolitionism or abolition on hand, do you want to share it?
I actually find abolition to be an incredibly difficult thing to define, because it's a process, and it's a verb, and those things are, like, very, very difficult to put, like, a fixed definition on. But one way that I generally like to introduce people to it is something that's really similar to what you were just talking about, Kiara, which is a quote from Ruth Wilson Gilmore. I think that this was the quote that, like, when I heard it the first time, it, like, clicked for me what abolition means, what police and prison abolition means specifically. And Ruth Wilson Gilmore is kind of, like, along with many others, she's just, like, the scholar of abolition geographies, along with many other folks, you know, like Angela Davis and Gina Dent and so many others, mostly Black and Indigenous women. But Ruth Wilson Gilmore describes abolition by saying abolition is about a presence, not an absence. It's about building life-affirming institutions. And that really drove home for me what it is. In the same book where she has this quote, she also goes on to talk about when we're talking about prison abolition in particular, we're not just talking about destroying buildings. Like, we're not talking about going out there and, like, tearing down buildings. We're also talking about replacing and building alternatives to the cultures and ideologies that allow buildings like prisons to exist, and that allow for, like, policing to exist in ourselves, between each other, and, like, bound up in our culture, that cause a lot of, like, shame and guilt and stigma and all of these things that so many people experience both internally and interpersonally. So whenever I'm talking about, like, whenever I'm talking about abolition, again, it's super hard to define, but I generally like to bring it back to the idea of it actually being quite a cultural process. That's the anthropologist in me. But also, as you were talking about, a process in which we relearn how to care for each other.
Yeah, I think what kind of drove this discussion for me today is it was an Instagram post of all things, but somebody had kind of created a like slideshow of posts about just starting to rethink, rethinking abolition with care at its center, that it's not just about changing the systems, like the, like, structural systems that we have in place, but also, like, learning to understand that, like, systems like prisons are violent. They're designed to, like, deeply damage communities and all the people involved in those systems, and, like, creating deep damage not only just to, like, individuals but to communities is not how we should be moving through this world. And looking at abolition as a way to, like, not only remove the prison system as, like, a part of our society, but also look at, okay, how do we handle harm, and how do we look at ways to kind of redress harms without causing further pain and damage to the people in our lives?
And I think, like, one thing that's really interesting about that, because you're talking about, like prisons and policing as a system, right, which it is, but I think like, thinking about how prisons and policing become a part of our cultural structures and systems, I think what has been really humbling for me is just recognizing the ways that policing and prisons show up even in places that you would never expect it. And the thing that that maybe it would be the most relevant to talk about in the context of like abolitionist care is the way that policing is tied up in healthcare. That like this is a place, like healthcare is a system that we think of as like the place to go to for literal care, like to heal from mental illness, to heal from physical injury, to heal from drug addiction, like all of these things. But the police are so bound up in healthcare responses to mental health crisis, in responding to an opioid crisis, that like the healthcare system can't even do the thing that it's meant to do, right? Like funding is being massively drawn from that system to be invested into like ongoing and ever expanding policing and away from like frontline care, and away from all of these like different ways that we could be culturally responding to different issues that are coming up for like different communities who are dealing with the ramifications of colonialism or racism, for instance. So yeah, it's so absolutely important that we understand that this is not just like a fight to get rid of one system, but to build care back into every system that we have, to kind of like create wraparound support for people. Because yeah, I mean, like people existed in communities and nations since time immemorial without policing. Like policing is actually like an incredibly new concept. We have many people to learn from, like the current context of people experimenting, like a million ways, like literally there is a project called 1 Million Experiments. That's like an archive of all of the way that people are like performing or building mutual aid projects, which are like tangibly replacing the police in their communities. And it's really exciting to see all of that happen.
Yeah. And I think that's also like coming back to abolition often being misunderstood. I think it's around policing. I think that comes up a lot. Because for a lot of people, I think we are taught to believe that police are the ones that, like, if crimes happen in our communities, they're going to keep us safe, or they're going to make sure those crimes don't happen again. And what happens if we get rid of police? Are we going to be just living in like a like lawless, quote unquote, mm-hmm. society? Mm-hmm. That's like dangerous to people. And I hope that we're getting to a place with these discussions where people are realizing that actually that's not what police were designed to do. That's not what police are doing.
Yes.
And like you said, there have been systems across time and space that have not been policing, that have made sure that we are able to like exist as communities safely, caring for each other, and also having systems of accountability. Like mm-hmm. getting rid of police does not mean that we have no system of accountability and no system of like redressing harm, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's a really important point that you just brought up, Kiara, which is like police were not made to keep people safe. Mm-hmm. Like police were made to steal Indigenous children here in Canada, to police enslaved peoples, enslaved Black peoples in the States and in Canada too, both, to like steal Indigenous land. Like police were there to create a nation state. They were not there to keep a community of people safe by any stretch of the imagination. And I know like whenever I'm talking to folks who are unsure about what abolition is, one of the first things that they will generally bring up is, well, you're a woman, because I'm a woman. You're a woman. Like, what would you do if you ever experienced like sexualized violence? Like, who would you call? And I'm like, I'm telling you right now, like, I would never call the police. Like, not ever. Like, I have already had harm done to me. I know for a fact that the police are like some of the greatest perpetrators of like domestic violence in the country. And then a number of survivors become criminalized, like literally are put into prison for defending themselves in situations where they're experiencing harm. But like that's the number one kind of like scenario that's presented of like, who are you going to call? But like, I'm already not calling the police. You know, like if I experience any kind of harm, or like my home is robbed or something gets stolen from me, like, I don't want to make a police report. I want to feel safe. So the person I'm going to be calling is like my amazing neighbor next door who I love, or like my sister-in-law, or the people that I work with, so that I actually like have a system of safety that I've already built, like there when I need them. And I will do the same for them, right? So it's kind of like building these like mutual aid pods, which is a Mia Mangus term from the Bay Area restorative justice team. But yeah, like there are so many systems that we have been building this whole time. So that are just like ready for us to draw on them and adapt them and continue experimenting. So yeah,
there are so many ways to just like reach out to people that are already around you, who you know will offer you the support you need, will be able to have like those reciprocal relationships with. Something that's kind of percolating in my head while we're talking is, I think for me personally, when I think about like what draws me towards like these types of movements, and this way of moving through the world, is just, sounds cheesy, but love. And even when we look at like, I hate the word crime, because it's such a socially like constrained word and constructed word. Like, what is a crime? It's very like socially dependent, and there's a lot of stuff going on there. But when we look at like crime, I guess, and like, for example, if something is stolen from you, my immediate response is never to be wanting revenge, which I feel like
no.
is the center of like our current like kind of systems of like redress for crime. I don't want revenge. My immediate thought is, oh, what might that person have needed?
What do they need exactly?
And like, why are they being put in a situation where this is the only way they can get it? And I think that's like at a really like core ethos of like why people are drawn to abolitionism, is because it's not centered around like punishment.
And also because there's not one way of doing it. It's like when we think about so much of what's happening that is resulting in, I also hate using the word crime, but in people breaking colonial laws, is like that is coming from a place of often deeply intersecting need. So the response to that is to do like almost anything that is like not calling the police, right? Like, it could look like, you know, starting like a community soup kitchen, or like regularly doing like clothing and good drives, you know, thinking about like in here in Vancouver, we have the amazing folks at like the Distro Disco. Who like every month on like the first Saturday of every month, they like bring together like money and goods from across the Lower Mainland to redistribute to people in need. By the way, like if whoever's listening, please every Saturday, like give stuff to them to redistribute.
They're wonderful people.
They're wonderful. You know, just like literally on days that are hot, just like taking out your big cooler, like buying some freezies, like walking around trying to keep people cool, like having your community feel supported by you, like you knowing your community, building a relationship with the community. Like, I think that it's like the perfect antidote to the lack of care that is leading to things like what we're seeing happening with like houselessness, and, you know, like people needing to steal food to be able to like stay alive. And I mean, I would say too, like, it is the love and like practice and experimentation and community building that also drew me into abolition work as well. And like I was saying before, how also it's like so deeply connected to like almost every other kind of social movement imaginable. Like, I have definitely found it very like a very easy transition, or like intersection, to go from like climate justice work into abolition work because they're the same thing. You know, it's like we have to fight back against indigenous land defenders and just like water protectors getting imprisoned for like fulfilling their responsibility to like defend the earth, right? So like it's also really easy to see the way that like care for our communities, like not being lured in to, you know, revenge, into like capitalist mentalities that create stigma, like these kinds of things. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that leads me really well into kind of my last question, I guess, or piece that I want to bring into this is kind of, I think what you've touched on with the connection between all these different forms of like these movements across our lives, whether it be like environmental activism or whatever. I think personally that an abolitionist mindset can actually like help us to widen our visions of who and what we care for.
Yeah.
Like breaking it beyond just like, I think often when we're like, who are we responsible to, immediately coming to mind, especially for myself as a settler and like being very embedded in like this kind of system of families, like, oh, it's my immediate family, it's my parents, it's my siblings, it's the people who I'm like immediately connected to right here right now, nuclear family, mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And there are so many more beings that we are responsible to, and I think that for me, abolition and like getting involved in these movements and learning about how we can care for each other has just broken that wide open. Even just, not only like people that are just like my neighbors or people who I encounter just on my day-to-day life, but also like plants and animals and like just like beings beyond humans. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Like I remember Okay, so you were talking earlier about like the way that you came into this conversation today was actually through like an Instagram post.
Yeah.
So one thing that I was seeing a lot of on Instagram, because I run our social media account for SF Perg, right? Like one thing that I see a lot of is this like, honestly, like quite narrow understanding of what mutual aid means on social media. I think that the thing that like really comes through when it comes to mutual aid on the internet is the idea of reparations or like wealth distribution. That's very, very strong. Mm-hmm. Because I think that like in a capitalist society, like we're so indoctrinated into capitalism that it's like, oh, if we care, then we like give money, right? But for me, like one thing that felt particularly really lacking besides, you know, like the more like relational kinds of mutual aid that I was talking about, you know, like making sure that people are fed. It could also look like, you know, provide like creating like community, like collective daycare, right? Like really anything that's relational. I could go on and on about this list, but like the thing that I really want to talk about here is mutual aid for non-human kin. Because before we did this interview, Kira and I were like talking about the garden and like how like in late stage capitalism and impending climate chaos. I'm like, well, I guess I better go like water the garden a little extra today. And yeah, so like one thing that really became really strong for me, especially with like the heat domes the last few years, is like, yeah, like I'm going out and making sure that people who don't have like easy access to water have access to water. But I'm also like going out and like making sure that like insects and birds have water, like my plants have extra water, like going out and attending like water ceremonies with creeks that have dried up, like going out and like making sure that salmon have ceremony to like welcome them back after like incredibly daunting travels, and then being met with like the wrong kind of water, is my understanding, too warm of water. Thinking about like cedar trees in the forest, you know, like any number of beings that exist alongside us that we're deeply dependent on. So like, where is our mutual aid also for these beings? So yeah, I'm like right there with you in terms of like really needing to like have this like constant constellations of like mutual aid systems that consider all of these different aspects.